Hello and welcome to Elucidations, an unexpected philosophy podcast. I'm Matt Teichman, and with me today are Lainey Ross, Carolyn and Matthew Buxbaum Professor of Clinical Ethics at University of Chicago Medicine, and Christos Lazaridis, Associate Professor of Neurology at University of Chicago Medicine. And they are here to talk about defining death. Lainey and Christos, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you, Matt, for having us.
And welcome back to Christos.
Thank you.
So in kind of part one of this episode with just Christos, we talked about brain death. I wonder if maybe we could just get back into the headspace by doing a quick little 101 on, like, what is brain death? What are we talking about?
Yes. I was thinking, Matt, to just do a quick recap and talk about how we determine death in the hospital. So we follow the UDDA, which is the Uniform Determination of Death Act. So that's the law about how to determine death. And this can be done in two ways. There are two sets of criteria that diagnose or determine the same event, which is death. So it's either by the irreversible cessation of circulatory and respiratory functions or the irreversible cessation of all functions of the brain and the brainstem, the so-called whole brain concept.
So, does one of those determine the other? Like, if you lose circulation and respiration, doesn't that also cut off your consciousness, or are they not causally connected?
So it does, and they are causally connected. Mm. However, this is not necessarily the rationale. Okay. And we can talk about this later. But if anyone meets either set of criteria, then they are determined to be dead.
So the topic of this episode is defining death. And you might think we just did it. You might think, well, that's the definition. We can all go home. But one of the things that you both have worked on is the fact that in many cases, there seems to be at least a little bit of wiggle room in exactly what criterion you're going to use to determine whether someone has undergone this process of death. What's the range of options there?
Under current law, under the current UDDA, there are the two options. There is the option of being declared dead by permanent loss of circulatory and respiratory function and the permanent loss of the whole brain. There are other options that one can envision, but under the law, those are the only two.
So just to follow up on what Lainey said, there is a third approach or concept, if you like, called higher brain death, which, by the way, it's not in law in any jurisdiction, but it's more of a scholarly proposal. The idea that not the entire brain or the whole brain is necessary for someone to be determined dead. And I think that relates more to the death of a person or the cessation of personhood. So people have talked about the higher brain in the sense that that's where consciousness is housed. And so the higher brain translates to the permanent or irreversible. By the way, there is debate about permanence and irreversibility, but let's say the permanent loss of the capacity of consciousness that equates to death. That's the higher brain position.
And is that different from the what we just talked about with the UDDA? Or is that the same, or is that just another way to think of irreversible cessation of consciousness?
No, so this goes back to your question about whether does death by circulatory lead to death by neurologic or vice versa, and this third one. So the fact is that there are two ways to determine death under the law. This third method would be not currently accepted under any law, neither in the United States or anywhere in the world, but it would, because there are two different ways to determine it, we also have to acknowledge then that we haven't actually given a pure definition of death. And so the fact is that these two different ways to determine it are social constructs. They are criteria that have been determined by healthcare providers. There have been many other stakeholders involved. But in the end, they're social constructs. What Christos has proposed is this third method, which would be death of just higher brain or a loss of the capacity for consciousness. So that's a third construct. You can envision that the reason that death can be determined by circulatory criteria is that it eventually will lead to death of the entire brain. If you have death of the whole brain, I would argue it's in that direction of association. If you lost the entire brain, you can continue to maintain cardiocirculatory. But eventually, once you've lost cardiocirculatory, you will lose entire brain function. Unless, of course, we do certain interventions to restore your cardiocirculatory.
Right. So the idea here is that left to your own devices, without the aid of life support technology, the one kind of death would lead to the other kind of death.
Correct. It's an interesting issue about how long it might take. And that would have important implications, for example, for organ transplantation.
I'm still kind of wondering, what is the difference between deciding somebody's dead based on neurological criteria and deciding that somebody's dead based on the loss of higher brain function? Is there, like, what would be the distinction there between the patients in each state?
Let me describe how we determine death by neurologic criteria currently, which is again based on the whole brain concept. So the idea here is that we test clinical functions of the different levels of the brain. We have someone, a patient, who is in a coma that suggests loss of higher cortical functions. And then we test clinical functions of the brainstem. And this is done in a standardized way. We check the different cranial nerves, and eventually, you know, we test the different sections of the brainstem, the midbrain, the pons, and the medulla. And the very last part of the test, or to complete the test, one needs to perform an apnea test, which tests the respiratory centers in the medulla. It involves disconnecting a patient from the ventilator, providing oxygen, but not ventilating them. And so there is, again, a standardized way that this is done. And at the end of the test, if someone does not take a breath spontaneously, then we determine that the apnea test shows that there is no medullary function.
So these are all functions of the brain that don't have to do with, like, thinking, but rather have to do with automatically regulating the body systems and keeping them going.
Yes, for homeostasis and bodily integration, absolutely.
Where if you would talk about higher brain or consciousness-based, then testing, for example, apnea or testing cranial nerve reflexes in the brainstem may not be necessary. Because you may
we still couldn't tell if the person can hear you or they know you're there or anything that we associate with conscious thought.
Right. You can be unconscious, right, without losing brainstem function.
Absolutely. Every night I sleep while I breathe while I sleep.
Right. Well, and that's why this becomes very quickly complicated. So, and part of the problem here is that is with current means of technology, is almost impossible to determine that the capacity for consciousness has been irreversibly been lost. We thought we could detect that, but it turns out it's very easy to be mistaken. And so
how do we think we could detect it? And, like, what was wrong about that? That's fascinating.
So a typical case, we used to have this syndrome. In fact, it still exists, the so-called vegetative state, right?
Right.
The idea that you can have somebody who has sleep-wake cycles, they have intact brainstem function, but they do not have any consciousness, right? The issue, one of the main problems is that detecting the state was through behavioral means.
Right.
And it turns out that when you use other means, for example, electrophysiology or advanced brain imaging, you see activations of brain parts that, although there is no behavioral output, they would still count as potentially signs of consciousness.
So what it seems we call like there's somebody still in there, even though they can't really
Correct.
Move or do anything.
Correct. Yeah. Correct.
One thing about that is that, particularly after a traumatic injury, the person may have no signs of consciousness for weeks, months, or even years, and then start to develop certain signs. And so this gets into the whole question of, is it truly permanent? And at what point can you say that somebody is permanently unconscious?
Is there, like, a world record of that? Like, has anybody been in a coma for 75 years or, like, you know, like some really alarming amount of time? I mean, I picked a high number.
There are cases of people who may be in comatose for over a decade.
Yeah.
Wow.
And
came back against all odds, against everybody's
prediction.
And they
start developing signs of minimal consciousness. Mm. Often you will hear families that, you know, they may detect signs of, you know, some purposeful movements, for example, eye movements, but these require spending a lot of time with the individual, and usually clinicians, we only have limited time and exposure to them, so it's difficult to, by behavior alone, to objectively detect signs of purposeful activity or consciousness.
And there have been certain individuals given certain drugs who have been able to, in a sense, have a short period of awareness and wakefulness. All very recent and really creating a real challenge for those who want to determine death by upper brain to be able to really say that it's permanent. Death needs to be a concept that's permanent.
Yeah, and you can imagine someone thinking, maybe if it's about a family member they love, well, you know, let's keep them and, like, you know, wait for the drugs that would be necessary to bring them back to be invented, et cetera, et cetera. You know, you can imagine, you know, people going through these emotional machinations like that.
This is definitely part of it. There's a real epistemologic problem in terms of how could we know that someone has permanently lost the capacity to be conscious. And as I said earlier, with current technologic means, that this is really close to impossible. The other issue is that we don't really know very well how consciousness arises. And so we're talking about higher brain, but at the same time, there are theories that put brainstem right at the center of consciousness generation. And so talking about just the higher brain may actually be misleading.
Do you think it's likely that future developments in neuroscience, brain imaging, etc., will kind of force us to change our definitions of what counts as dead according to these criteria? Or, like, how likely do you think that is?
It's an interesting question. Part of it, right now, when we determine death, we consider it a clinical test, both for circulatory death as well as death by neurological criteria. One could imagine a change that would say that it's required for the determination of death to include some ancillary testing, whether an EEG or looking at blood flow or something of that sort. And so if that were to become the law of the land, that would really change how we determine death.
Okay, so we've established two things. One, it's kind of morally really important to try to be clear about whether a person is dead or not. On the one hand. On the other hand, it's really hard to do it, and we don't necessarily always have the medical technology to be able to do it. So what do we do faced with those two things? Are we just in a dilemma, or is there a way through?
So if I understand the question, what you're asking is, given that there are different criteria that are being used, how then do we know that somebody is dead? Because that leads to changes in the way we treat the body. We treat people who are living one way. Once you declare dead, it changes how you are treated. It also changes your relationship with your family member. You go from being a spouse to a widow and things of that sort. So
yes,
it's really important to know at what moment you are alive and at next moment when you're declared dead. To the extent that we have these two determinations, it already tells us, and that I've suggested, that the permanent loss of circulatory and respiratory function will eventually lead to death of the entire brain, including the brainstem, suggested it's not purely a biological test that we're talking about in this determination, that there is some degree of it's value laden. And once you start realizing then that our determinations of death involve values, we can say that there's a social construct of death. And if we accept that, then one question comes, why just these two options? These are the two that are enshrined in the UDDA, but it doesn't mean that these are the only two. So there are a group of people, and I include myself in that group, who would love to be declared dead by higher neurological function. Unfortunately, right now, we don't have a great set of tests that would ensure permanent death by higher brain function. So I understand that won't happen, at least not right now. It's also the case I might not be ready to die right now.
So maybe the wish is like, well, if there's a good test by the time I pass away, I would prefer that to be a criteria right. To be used.
Well, or if there were a good test at the time where I were to have lost permanent upper right, consciousness, then I would like to be determined to be dead by those criteria, yes.
Right.
Now, it's really important that that's the type of choice that I, as a first person, decide. I think we can get into a lot of trouble if we allow family members to just say, oh, this is the way we're going to determine death for this person, because sometimes there might not be the purest of motives.
Right.
It would be really important if we were going to make that one of the options for how death is determined, that we really were to educate the public at large so that people who wanted that determination were to make that while living and make their wishes clearly known.
And it seems like if you pick the irreversible loss of higher brain function criterion, you're making it easier to count as dead, count yourself as dead, than if you pick the circulatory criterion. And that could be something that you and your family members disagree about, that you might disagree about how easy it should be for you to count as dead.
Yes.
Can I add something?
Oh, please, yes.
Just want to go back. I don't want us to create the misperception that current criteria are loose or that they are not well-defined. So there are standardized ways to determine death by circulatory criteria, and there is a standardized way to determine death by neurologic criteria. There are guidelines for both, and determinations, for obvious reasons, have to follow those guidelines. Now, there are challenges. For example, in terms of the neurologic criteria, one challenge that's out there and has led to the United Law Commission, for example, looking at revising the UDDA now, is the current tests we use, do they really test the whole brain? So that is a debate. That's an open question. And several people, I think, they argue convincingly that no, we do not test all of the functions of the entire brain. So that's somewhere where the language of the UDDA could potentially be modified. On the other hand, even for circulatory criteria, and I'm just going to give you an example where there is an open challenge that has to do with circulatory criteria, is in something that we call donation after the circulatory determination of death. Okay? And there, death is declared after 5 minutes of no circulatory function, for example, 5 minutes of cardiac standstill. And if there is no activity in the heart within these 5 minutes, then death is declared at that point. So one challenge that has come up is 5 minutes enough? Why 5 minutes? Okay. But these are side challenges to these sets of criteria. The criteria are there, they're standardized, and they are implemented hundreds of times or thousands of times every day.
So in your minds, is the question about whether to count someone as dead the same question or a different question than the practical question, like, am I going to withdraw life support or not?
Well, they're very distinct issues. So you can decide to withdraw life support because, for example, I have an advance directive that says that I don't want you to intubate, or I didn't want to be intubated if I'm already intubated. You might want to refuse life-sustaining treatment, for example, if you were dying of other causes and this would just prolong the dying process. So there are reasons why withdrawal is actually very separate. Now, once a person is declared dead by neurological criteria, then the question is, what do you do with a individual who's now declared dead but is still on a ventilator, so still having circulation despite the fact that the individual is dead? And so there might be a decision about withdrawal of the ventilator after death has already been declared. Clearly, to be dead by circulatory and respiratory function, you would have already have had to had the ventilator withdrawn, because otherwise you would still be oxygenating and ventilating, even though it was being helped by mechanical means. So they're really very separate. It becomes important in the area, again, just about respecting the individual's choice about withdrawal of life-sustaining treatment, but it also becomes important in the issue of when is someone declared dead and so that their organs could be procured for transplantation.
Right, okay. So it's maybe in certain respects can be a similar type of question about when to do it, but there are many cases in which the question comes up where the person is clearly not dead, I guess is what we should say about that.
Even if you're not dead, in fact, particularly when you're not dead, if you have an advance directive that says you would not want to be resuscitated or that you would not want to be maintained on life support, you would have the right to have those therapies withdrawn. More problematic is, what if you're declared dead by neurological criteria, but your family wants to keep your body perfused, the oxygen perfused, so that you look warm and you look like you're just sleeping, even though you've now been declared dead?
Yeah, let's get back into that. I'm intrigued by what you said earlier, namely that it should be your decision rather than your family's decision as the patient. Maybe we could talk about why that is. I can certainly think of a lot of friends of mine who would think, no, it should be the family's decision because they're the ones who are going to have to live with the loss of the person, et cetera, et cetera.
So let me just clarify. So I agree that families are the ones who have to live with the outcomes. My feeling is that we have these two ways to determine death, and those are sort of the standard ways. Once you start talking about determining death by higher brain function, that's sort of an outlier, and it's at that point where it really should be the individual choosing and not the family. On the other end, so that's the more, you could say, the more liberal. On the more conservative, where the only reason I want to be declared dead is by circulatory, and so my family might not be willing for religious reasons to accept death by neurological criteria, even if I were to do the full clinical tests and be able to say that this body now meets the determination of death by neurological criteria, they might want to maintain the ventilator in order to keep the body perfusing. They may have a belief that as long as there's breath, there's life. And so in that case, we probably should not have actually done the whole testing to determine whether the individual is dead by neurological criteria. Now, there may be good reasons and bad reasons. It may be that the family knows that this individual values somatic existence. But again, because that's the outlier, since almost all of us in the United States have accepted these two different ways to determine death, I think the outliers really should be a first-person consent issue, that I get to say, if I want to go off the standard routine, I should make my wishes well known.
Are there people with the opposite preference to you who strongly prefer for the circulatory criterion to be used on them?
Yeah, I mean, so in New Jersey, they currently have an exception clause. It's based on religion, that you can refuse to be determined to be dead by neurological criteria if, for example, you're an Orthodox Jewish family, but other religions as well. If you give a religious belief that the definition of life and death is based on respiration, with good technology, we can keep respiration going for weeks, months, and years, even if there's really no brain function.
So, for example, would it be coherent to say that I object to circulatory criteria? Right. And that connects back to what you actually mentioned, the idea that when systemic circulation ceases, brain circulation ceases as well. And that's why most of the challenges that make it to the courts, for example, have to do with neurologic criteria. So people object to the idea of be determined dead as long as there's a heart beating.
You could imagine a court challenge if a family was told that the physicians would refuse to perform ECMO, so that's extracorporeal mechanical oxygenation. Let's say you had bad trauma and you want to give the heart and lungs some time to rest to see if they'll be able to function again. And if for whatever reason this hospital said we refuse to do it, there might be a case where refusing to accept cardiocirculatory definitions of death could happen.
I think that would fall within conflict between a family requesting measures that the clinical team would consider inappropriate on the basis of neurologic prognosis, for example.
Right. Which is, again, a value judgment about what is a correct quality of life worth living, and gets into the whole notion that death really does have this value component.
Right. So I guess the idea is, if it's part of my religious belief that, you know, if I'm breathing, I'm alive, then I might really strongly want the circulatory criterion to hold for me. If, on the other hand, I think that life involves something crucially more than just breathing, namely being able to consciously think and have relationships with other people and interact with them in some way, something like that, maybe that will push me more to want the higher brain criterion to apply to me. So is that the way to think about the decision calculus here?
Yeah, I would say, you know, I wouldn't restrict it to the higher brain. I would just say, you know, you would want neurologic criteria. And then, you know, we can discuss about what these criteria should be. What are the necessary and sufficient criteria to determine that someone has died based on brain function?
Right. But I could imagine that I would want it to be more than just automatic, you know, kind of reflexes, but no ability to interact with other people, have relationships, etc.
Well, all the definitions with neurologic would all include the permanent loss of consciousness.
Okay,
but your
yeah
point is very well taken, because if I have permanent loss of consciousness and I can be declared dead by whole brain criteria, but if I have a weak gag and that's the only test that I fail,
yeah,
or
exactly,
I
yeah
have a test where if you put cotton on my eyeball, I have a blink reflex, that might be enough to say that I don't meet the criteria for the determination of death by neurological criteria.
Yeah,
and
that's great.
I
yeah
can't see the moral value of a weak gag, and so that's why I would want to be declared dead by just upper brain
right
criteria.
And, right. A lot of people, I think, would agree that that doesn't count as living, really, just being able to do those things.
But I do think it's important that we have very specific protocols for the determination of death. We don't want this to just be any criteria are adequate. There really has to be a clear determination, because we treat people and bodies very differently when they're living versus when they're dead. And even if it's a social man-made construct, there still has to be a line before which I'm alive and after which I'm dead, and different behaviors come in response to that. I go from being a spouse to my husband would then become a widow. I go from having life insurance to my life insurance kicking in and things of that sort. So it's really important to understand the determination of when an individual is declared dead.
Yeah, so this is all going to be within a certain range. I mean, like, you could imagine somebody being really ridiculous, being like, well, if I don't make this amount of money, I might as well not be living, or, you know, like, so completely outlandish criteria like that, we're going to rule those out. But within this, you know, sort of generally accepted by the medical community to be reasonable range, we can have
correct
a preference.
And Christos mentioned the Uniform Commission of Legislatures. The UCL is considering now whether we need to make any revisions to the two standard determinations of death. But again, most of the discussion is based about sort of tweaking these criteria and not looking for an entirely new determination of death.
That's correct. Like, for example, this whole higher brain conversation does not enter at all, you know, the current discussion.
And one of the reasons I'm an observer on that committee and I haven't pushed it is because I acknowledge that we don't currently have the ability to determine permanent cessation of upper brain function. If we could, then I would really hope that we would be able to modify our Uniform Determination of Death Act.
Yeah. Fascinating.
But the fact that we want to tweak it, also I just want to keep emphasizing, goes back to the fact that it's not just biological criteria, that death really is a social construct. And so while clinicians should have the authority to make determinations of death, I think it's much broader number of stakeholders, including the public, including the people listening to this podcast, who need to help define what are, in a sense, the two different ways that we're going to determine death. And that may be based on personal holistic values. It may be based on religious and spiritual values. And that's all okay. And we should be able to have a system that can accommodate people with widely disparate beliefs. And so therefore, some who may say, as long as I have breath, I'm alive, we should be able to respect that, just as we should be able to respect eventually the person who says, if I can't, you know, have meaningful relationships and be aware of my surroundings, that I too want to be declared dead.
I want to add that I, although I agree with Lainey, I want to highlight that there's large disagreement about what kind of question is, what is death? Should it be treated as a purely biological question to be answered by facts in biology, or should it take into account moral, normative reasons and issues on how to define death as policy, as a social construct? And I would venture to say that at least until now, the view that it's a question that should take into account moral facts, normative facts, and it's a construct, it's a minority view. I think the dominant view has been that this is a biologic question. And that's where the more recent challenges, I mean, not recent, they've been around for some time, about brain death have to do with the fact that it doesn't really match biologic reality. And now it becomes a deep and interesting question about, for example, you have to define what an organism is. And when you turn to biologists and philosophers of biology, they actually give you multiple answers. There's not one agreed upon definition of what an organism is. Yeah. And so
or what life is, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
Which is a really important point, is that the same debates we're having about at what moment do we change from treating a person as a living person and now declare them dead and treat them as a decedent, we have those same debates about when does life begin.
Absolutely, yeah.
And while there are processes of being born and there are processes of dying, at one moment you have to be born and at one moment you have to be dead.
One disanalogy there, I guess, is that breathing dramatically changes from gestation to birth in maybe a way that, you know, it doesn't for death. It seems, I don't know, it struck me that that's maybe like a difference
in
those two.
You can view the placenta as the ECMO of the fetus.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
But these same debates are happening at the other extreme as well, right? And again, it gets into the difference on how we treat persons and human persons versus how we treat other animals, both at when does life begin and when does death occur.
So speaking of pregnancy, doesn't the question about how exactly to determine death interact in kind of interesting ways with pregnancy? Like what happens if somebody is in a, you know, one of these borderline states while pregnant?
Yeah. Again, this gets into the fact that even if someone can be declared dead by neurological criteria, we can keep their body oxygenated with technology. And so it does raise the question of, you have a living fetus inside a woman who's declared dead by neurological criteria. And what do you do? Do you, if the fetus is 36 weeks and could live and breathe on its own, do you treat it differently and do you take the woman to the operating room versus if the fetus is only 12 weeks? And then you get into questions of whether you're going to maintain circulation of the woman so that she continues to gestate the fetus. Again, really personal questions, something that most pregnant women are not thinking about. And so when you get into these horrible scenarios, the most likely event is that the docs are going to turn to the family and ask, how do you want to go ahead? But people also need to understand that there's laws in many states, including the one we're sitting in right now, which says that my advance directive, which tells you what I would want done with my body, doesn't have to be respected when I'm pregnant here in the state of Illinois. And so that the doctors, my husband, can make healthcare decisions that really violate my expressed wishes as documented in my advance directive.
Yeah, I could see, you know, for political slash religious reasons, different states and different countries kind of coming down differently on that question, whether or not to respect the wishes of the pregnant mother prior to brain death, or whether or not to prioritize the birth of the gestating fetus over everything.
Yes. So it's not just in the issue of death. I mean, we get in the issues of pregnancy, a woman who has cancer, whether she has the right to say that I'm going to take these drugs that will kill a fetus in order to try to save my own life. So the maternal fetal conflict is real and not just at these edges.
And Matt, let me also mention that the example of the pregnant woman who is determined to be dead by neurologic criteria and yet remains on artificial support for weeks or months and gestates a healthy fetus, it really puts a lot of pressure and tension to this idea that the brain is the central integrator and that without the brain, the homeostatic integration of the organism falls apart, because it demonstrably doesn't, right? And that's why people have challenged this idea that you would call a living pregnant organism that is gestating a fetus as a cadaver. And so I think that challenges the
idea.
That'd
be a crazy tale to tell your friends in school growing up, right? When I was born, my mother was a corpse. That would be a weird conversation to have.
Exactly. And I think that's where you have to move from purely biologically defining death to when death behaviors are appropriate, which incorporates, as we just said, moral issues and normative issues.
Slightly tangential, but really important to think about what that might mean for the caregivers at the bedside. I just want everyone to sort of take a pause and think about the fact, particularly if a woman like myself were to have very strong preferences about how my body should be treated once declared dead by neurological criteria. Even if I were to have said while alive that my wish is to bring a healthy baby into the world and I have a family willing to support this child and all of that, and so this is a great thing, I still think from the perspective of the caregivers at the bedside, the difficulty of caring for a body that is dead in order to bring this fetus to term would be very emotionally challenging. When we think of what we do in medicine, we don't think we're drawing blood from a dead body, caring for a dead body in the way that we do in the intensive care unit versus in preparation for burial or cremation.
So I think what we've established in this discussion so far is that it's far from simple to determine whether someone is living or dead in at least numerically many cases, if not proportionally many cases, and that this is a reality that physicians have to wrestle with on a day-to-day basis. So now that we've acknowledged that there's this complexity where we have to bring in moral considerations, legal considerations, and not just purely scientific or biological considerations, where do you think we should go from there?
Well, the good news is it's not a daily basis. It's often pretty straightforward whether someone is alive or dead. These are sort of the cases at the margins. And one of the things that I've always argued for is the value of choice, given that these are tensions and one can see one can understand why different people coming from different religious and other social backgrounds might have very different views. It argues for the value of allowing all the states to look like New Jersey. So in New Jersey, you can choose whether you only want to be declared dead by circulatory and respiratory criteria, or whether you're also willing to be declared dead by neurological criteria. The idea, though, that it's only in New Jersey where you have this freedom, it's technically in about 7 states that there's some degree of accommodation, but New Jersey is the clearest of them. But what about the other 43 states? And it seems to me that where we should move is to just acknowledge the right for individuals to make these decisions about how they want to be determined to be dead throughout all 50 states, and so that there should be the case for choice. Some people worry that this will lead to huge costs of oxygenating bodies that have no neurological function and things of that sort. I again just want to emphasize it's the rare individuals who really think that that's a living person there. And so I think that'll be a rare exception. If we were to accept death by higher brain, the cost would even out because those individuals would be declared dead sooner. And even if we don't accept death by higher brain, the fact is the costs have not been prohibitive. The number of cases in New Jersey are small, and I think that even if we expanded it across the United States, the numbers would remain small and would be more respectful of all of us in who live in this pluralistic liberal society.
As a born and bred New Jerseyan, I could not possibly be happier with the suggestion that other states should all become like New Jersey. Leni Ross and Christos Lazaridis, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Matt.
The Elucidations blog has moved. We are now located at elucidations.now.sh. On the blog, you can find our full back catalog of previous episodes. And if you have any questions, please feel free to reach out on Twitter at elucidationspod. Thanks again for listening.